Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone, running just a little bit late. I was on time, and I'm just kidding. Our guests were on time, and I was just having a bad hair day, and as you can see, that happens a lot around here. My name is Patrick Timpone, and this is OneRadioNetwork.com. We're going to have a great time this morning. Looking forward to it. The 21st of July, 2021. If you'd like to be on the show, we have an 800 number. Nobody uses it any longer because it doesn't involve your thumbs, but try it. You can just 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Just a couple bits of business here before we go. We saw that Thomas Renz, the great attorney out of Ohio, that we've had on the show a few times, he's just filed a federal lawsuit out of Alabama coordinated with the American Frontline Doctors, suing the federal government for killing, in his words, they have a whistleblower with an affidavit, and she sees the numbers, and this is just one of 12 systems that reports 45,000 deaths from this injection, with a sworn affidavit from a whistleblower who says, I can show you the numbers, the real numbers. Again, this is only one system, the 45,000 out of 10 to 12 that report. So we're keeping an eye on these kind of things, and we'll have Mr. Renz on again. He's a great attorney out of Ohio trying to protect us from whatever this is. Again, if you'd like to be on the show, 888-663-6386. Let me just put our guests on camera and say hi to them. Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. Dr. Andrew Kaufman is there in the middle. Hi there. He's a natural healing consultant. He's an inventor, public speaker, and as you'll hear, he speaks pretty public and pretty good. Forensic psychiatrist. Boy, I could use that. I need a little head. Well, an expert witness. Psychiatric training, Duke University Medical Center after graduating from Medical University in South Carolina. He also has a BS from MIT up there with Stephanie Seneff and molecular biology. So he's been around. He hasn't just fallen off the old turnip truck. He's been building on the work of virologist Stefan Lanka with Tom Cowan and other people like Amanda Vollmer, Melissa Sell, and our other guest you can see on your right there, which is Dr. Bear Londo. Hi there, Bear. How are you?
Hey, Patrick. Good to see you again. Good to see you again also, Andy.
Nice,
absolutely, Bear.
Nice to have you here. Bear's a cool guy. He completed graduate studies in social psychology, earned his MICP certification from Stanford Medical School, then attended naturopathic college, and that was also Oriental medicine, classic homeopathy. He studied all kinds of stuff, muscular skeletal medicine, doctor of chiropractic degree, summa cum laude, kinesiology. And when he graduated from college, finally, when he was 45, he went out and got a job. So he was in there a long time. And he was really into the whole biological terrain thing of medicine. And Andrew, Dr. Bear, is your, do I call you Paul or Bear? Why do I call you?
Bear works.
Bear works. Okay, Bear works. Dr. Kaufman, did you discover the whole terrain thing or get more involved in it from Bear's work? He told me before the show.
Yeah, well, it's a great story, and this is really, I think, how I got connected with Bear and Mike Winter, is that back in November of 19, I was starting to look into, you know, germ theory in general, and Louis Pasteur and Antoine Béchamp, and they had recently done a fantastic show where they actually went through some of the famous book, Pasteur or Béchamp, I'm blanking on the author's name right now, and that was really my first sort of academic introduction, because they presented a lot of scientific material, and that really helped kind of propel me on the path that I've been on for the last year and a half.
Uh-huh. And Beauchamp, was he was a fellow that was the real show me the virus and no germ theory guy early on?
Well, he did a lot of experimentation with fermentation and you know, came up with the conclusion that, you know, organisms live within inside of us and they aren't necessarily contagions. And then Louis Pasteur plagiarized and twisted a lot of his work to foster the germ theory.
I see. Could you guys do something for me? Because, gentlemen, guys, could you do something for me? Because I've got a little issue that I have to text my geek in California. He's going to come and fix it. Would you just, gentlemen, talk among yourself? Yeah, they're already calling me saying, where are we? Let me put you on. Just talk about life or love. Hold on a second. Where are you? Talk about yourself. You know, smoke them if you got them. I'll be right back.
Sure thing. So, Bear, you know, I thought it was really fascinating when you guys introduced that subject, because it kind of really goes against, you know, everything that's taught in school and university, right? And Beauchamp, as a scientist, is really, you know, not in the common lexicon. So I was, you know, curious, how did you come to that material way long ago in when you were studying with you know, the sort of terrain theorists about proteids, or, and how was that part of their teaching?
No, it wasn't at all part of the naturopathic curriculum, and definitely not part of the chiropractic curriculum either. But I was simultaneously working in circles where we were developing something called applied kinesiology. I was one of the first tier of those people, and then it developed in the kinesiology, which was very much making inroads into a different understanding of neurology, and certain medical doctors from Europe, mostly from Germany, were saying, wow, you're actually directly accessing the autonomic nervous system, and this is the only way we can see that, you know, it can be done, what you guys are doing. So some of them came over to study with us. And in the process, I was introduced to bioterrain theory, you know, which was the old school German microscopy, and you know, the whole you know, the whole strategy of looking at the blood under the microscope and understanding that microbes have a very important role in our body, and that they go through what we call pleomorphic changes and actually provide very important functions in the body. So that really was amazing to me at the time. And, you know, I got my first microscope, live cell microscopy, and I've spent thousands of hours staring into that thing, you know, ever since. And that was, I don't care to say how many years ago that was.
Well, that's okay. But, you know, I want to like kind of impart this big idea that really Beauchamp was the first one to discover the particle involved in this, right? But what he discovered in those studies on fermentation and also putrefaction, which is the decay of animal flesh after death, right, is that it was originally thought that you needed a microorganism from the air, right? Like a yeast or a fungus to cause the fermentation or to, you know, convert sugar, right, to grape sugar. But then he found out that this could happen in a completely closed system, right? Meaning that the microorganisms actually come from within the plant or animal, rather than from the outside. And then this led to the microscopic discovery, right, of this primordial particle, if you will, right, which is really kind of a speck of light also, right, and energy. And he called it the somatid, I believe. Is that right? Or did he have a different name? But what, it's had many names, right?
He called it a protid. Forgive me, Beauchamp didn't call it that. He had different names, microzymes and things
microzymes,
like that.
But,
yeah,
so
Gaston
Naissant, right,
coined the term. Yeah, Gaston Naissant coined the term somatid, and then Gunther Enderlein used the term protid, but we're all talking about the same thing, I believe.
Right, and even Wilhelm Reich probably called it the biont, right, as well, talking about really the same thing. And even Rife may have been referring to the same thing, calling it a virus, right? I agree with that. Right. But what these are is like the primordial pluripotential of life. It's like the stem cells of the microorganism system, right? And actually the developmental and differentiation pathway, the so-called, you know, somatid cycle, is really the same thing that they tell us happens with stem cells in our bone marrow or in other tissues, right? How it goes through this development, although they don't cycle it back around to the stem cells, but essentially, you know, the same kind of process, and that this happens like in our body spontaneously when the need arises.
Exactly. It's also consistent with what you can observe in nature all around us. It happens in the soil on my farm. I observe that. That in insect life, all of life goes through these life cycles, including human beings. We go through our own life cycle and have different attributes and appearances, you know, as we go through those cycles. So just by observation, that's how I learned. And then also applying, you know, what I observed in clinical medicine, and then seeing, you know, being able to observe the results of the outcome.
Right. And so when you like look at a live blood analysis under the microscope, right, you're actually looking for these forms, right? And then you're looking for the amount of them, the health of them, right? And how many are turning into other microbial forms.
Yes, and there are different families of these microorganisms, and each one of them we know to have certain in the body at different life cycle changes. And what I do with the microscopes, if I take a blood sample, I'll have developers that are actually the proteids from those different families of microorganisms. And then I'll prepare various amounts of slides, each one with a different developer, and then look at those under the microscope. And then you'll see instant changes of pleomorphic development into higher valences in these life cycles that, you know, then tell you which are prominent, which gives you an indication of what kind of processes right. are going on. And sorry, Patrick.
No, you guys were great. I was kind of listening. When I, you know, I had a little PhD in the microbiology virology right there, man.
Well, you know, I want to point out, though, something, Bear, because this is, you know, like, I mean, I know this, we're educating people here, but the process you just described of looking at the blood for these pathways of microorganisms, right, that different patterns and different variants give you a different picture that goes with different disease states, right? So doctors conventionally do the exact same thing, looking at blood smears, except they're looking at dead blood cells, but they look at which of the subspecies of the blood cells are predominant. Like, is it the more immature forms? Right? Is it even progenitor or closer to the stem cells? And they tell you also the same thing. What's the nature of the disease? Is it hemolytic anemia? Is it cancer? Is it liver disease? And you can tell all those things from those patterns. So really, you're talking about using the same type of observations, the same microscopic techniques, but you're just expanding it, right, to look at the total biology instead of just focusing on one area. And then the big, big difference is that, you know, things change when they're dead, right? We know this, like, just by, if there's a dead body, right, it gets stiff, rigor mortis, right? And that means that the tissue and the cellular structure has got to have changed in some way, so that when we look at dead things under a microscope, it doesn't tell us what's going on when those things are alive, right? Because there's a change with death. So this can be really misleading, whereas the technique that Bear uses and many others who embrace terrain theory, you know, the Bigelson brothers are certainly a powerhouse that come to mind here, we're actually looking at living cells so we could observe what they're doing, right? And then we see that they behave differently in disease states. And so we can tell real information from the actual living organism right before us, you know, using this. And that is just such an advantage in scientific understanding. And people don't realize that all the medical research that's been done under the establishment is only looking at dead things.
So does this tie into Dr. Kaufman with you and others work with this idea of looking at things in a petri dish after they've done this and that and mixed and matched it, and, you know, antibiotics and monkey cell, God knows what. It's the same principle you're talking about here.
Well, they don't look at it while it's in the petri dish living and doing its thing. No, because, you know, all of the dogma that they tell us about what viruses are and how they make us sick, nobody has ever been able to observe a virus do any of those things in a living organism, because they are so small, these particles that allegedly are viruses, that they could only be seen with an electron microscope. And an electron microscope, not only do you have to kill whatever you're looking at, but you have to actually pretty much put it through a nuclear holocaust before you can visualize it
really
under the microscope. So, oh yeah, you have to, you know, heat it, you shoot it with an electron beam, you bombard it with heavy metals. What you're actually seeing is not the actual proteins or lipids or carbohydrates in the biological sample. You're actually seeing heavy metals that have been blasted in there to replace those components. But we don't know, you know, does it replace it one-to-one, right? Does it replace proteins the same as lipids, the same, you know, as carbohydrates? Like, what can we actually learn from this? Because we're, you know, observing kind of like a partial fingerprint that's been smudged, right? And so what can you tell about a person's, you know, behavior from a partial smudged fingerprint?
Well, on CSA, they can find a guy with a partial, you know how that is, CSI.
Well, no, you might be able to find somebody, but that wasn't what I said. I said, what can you tell about the behavior of that person?
The behavior.
Right? Now, you might be able to tell that they touched wherever the fingerprint is, but other than that, you can't tell. Were they a criminal? Were they a kind person, right? Were they wealthy or poor? Were they religious or atheist? You can't tell any of that. But we are told that viruses do this, that, and the other thing from that partial smudged fingerprint.
Dr. Kaufman, you and Kaufman and Bear and others, Vollmer, the rest of y'all, we say you all in Texas, you've been wanting to say, okay, well, show me the virus in an electron microscope, and then, you know, then we'll talk, right? And no one has done that, and your conjecture is because it doesn't exist. But what I just heard you say is they couldn't, I mean, let's just say there really was a virus that's out there getting people. You know, Pasteur was right and Beauchamp was wrong and you guys were wrong. Could they actually look at it under an electron microscope and prove? I mean, could it be done if it did exist?
Well, Patrick, you know, aside from the faults of the procedure, you know, of the microscopy, which is something we have to really strongly consider, in order to, you know, show that something made people sick, you'd actually just have to have it, right, in some kind of purified form where it's only that, right? Because when you do an experiment, you want to test one thing, not 100 things, because then you don't know which of the 100 things caused your result. You have to isolate one variable. Right? So that would mean having just the virus. Now, the microscope can tell you if there's one thing in the sample, because you look at it and all you'll see is many of one thing. Like, imagine, you know, those ball pits that the kids jump into, right? They're filled with balls and all those balls are the same size. Now, they might be different colors, right? But imagine they're all the same color. So if you saw, you know, 100 blue balls or 1,000 blue balls that were all the same size and looked the same, and that was all you saw under the microscope, you'd at least know you have one thing. And then you could do experiments with that one thing. Like, you could actually give it to an animal host and see if it makes them sick in the same way. Right? And so that's how you would do that experiment. And they've done this, by the way, successfully for nearly, 60 years with bacteriophages, which are, you know, allegedly viruses that infect bacteria in a pure culture. But they're misunderstood. But nonetheless, they can still find these particles, purify them, show them to exist. And then the same thing with exosomes, which are particles put off by our own body that are found in various, almost every kind of disease. And in people with lung cancer or even AIDS, they've been able to find these exosomes in body fluids like the blood or lung fluid and purify them so they just have them by themselves. And then they do studies on them. They can pull out the genetic material and say that where it came from. And they've done this many times. They can say what proteins it's made of, do all kinds of experiments on it because they just have one thing that they can examine. And they've, since the early 50s and late 1940s, they've never attempted this with viruses because they know they can't actually find them because they're not actually there.
Because they're not actually there. Dr. Andrew Kaufman and Bear Paul Londo are with us. Sorry about the, but the streaming thing is working now, so we were back. And okay, Dr. Kaufman, I've been wanting to ask you this forever. Okay, so this whole Wuhan Chinese lab, you know, this whole story, if somebody in China or somewhere could create something that looked or acted like a virus in a lab, could they release that in the air or give it to a bat and somebody has bat soup and then people could spread that? Do you know what I'm getting at? I mean, is that whole theory even workable? Does it even fly? You know what I'm asking?
Well, you know, it's not based on a phenomenon that has been shown in nature. But, you know, I would say the same thing. If there's an engineered virus that's out there, well, where's the proof of it? Because they haven't, you know, isolated and purified that either. Right? But what they can certainly do is they can experiment with some of these made-up genetic sequences to try and make toxic proteins, and they can use those in vaccines and other products.
Right.
And, you know, if there were any technology that could kind of disseminate this to the population, the one thing I could think of is these robotic mosquitoes that are actually been developed.
Uh-huh.
And those can, you know, basically fly around and inject people with substances.
Oh, good.
Okay. And that you know, but it would take that kind of technology, so, I think, to be able to.
So what I hear you saying, Doc, is that if you create something, some kind of a poison, you just couldn't release it in the air, and then people would breathe it in and then breathe it out and share it with somebody. Am I hearing you correct?
Well, that's what you could if it was ricin. Or mustard gas. I mean, that's chemical weapon, right?
How
they have been distributed. But no, there's no, you know, little particles with genetic material that are capable of making you sick that you can float around there. And, you know, even if you could, it's really kind of preposterous. Like someone did a calculation where they added up all of the, like, you know, reported, now this is of course false information, but they did this as an exercise, all of the reported cases in the world, and then from the PCR data estimated how many viral particles would be in each one, and multiplied it out to basically calculate the volume of virus particles if they were all put in one cup for the whole world. And it would basically fill up like one 12-ounce can of soda.
Wow.
And that would be the entire volume of, you know, alleged virus particles in the entire world that exist. Now, how
really?
How would that amount of stuff disseminate globally and be in enough concentration to invade people and make them sick? You know, it would just be impossible because out in the environment, things get diluted according to the inverse square law. So like for every 1 foot away, sorry, for every 2 feet away, it's a quarter of the number of particles that you're exposed to, right? And so, you know, it'd be 1/10,000th if it were 100 feet away. So, you know, just given the dimensions of the Earth, you see that it wouldn't be able to spread realistically more than a mile or two.
Bear, do you think there's anything that you and I together, our friends, could share with one another just breathing in and out? I mean, does it even work like that? Anything? I mean, herpes or STDs or, I don't know, something? Anything?
Well,
other than exosomes that we create, right? Other than exosomes that we create. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, the short answer is no. And when bioterrain medicine, we understand there's only natural processes meant to heal, and that microbes are not contagions, or do they cause disease? And if there are bioengineered bioweapons, we'll call them, which I kind of believe there are, then viruses, since they're not alive, they would, in my thinking, need to be conjugated with live cells somehow. And then the only way I can fathom them entering another person is by injection. And so, you know, I'd agree with Andrew, you know, maybe if you could introduce those to the tick populations or mosquito populations, or convince people that they need a shot, then of course that's a great way to introduce those into the you know, into the population. And alleged virus, if they do exist the way they say, you know, it would be like throwing a mosquito into a volcano, you know, to try to have those proteins survive the defenses of the human body, just to get through all the mechanisms that would destroy that protein on the moment. So I don't see how it's possible myself.
So the idea of a virus being created in a lab, to be clear, has been put out there by the media and the people that want to, you know, just China, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't fly, that idea that you could create something, put it out there, breathe it in, and then share it with you guys. We could share it. It just, scientifically, it just can't happen. It just doesn't work. Is that correct?
That, you know, they Patrick, they did an experiment to try and look at this back in 1918, 1919, done by Breslau in Boston under the United States Public Health Service. And what they did is they did more than this experiment, but I'll just describe this one experiment. They had a group of prisoners that they said, if you subject yourself to the Spanish flu and survive, you'll be free from prison. And then they rounded up people in like the Spanish flu ward at the hospital who were, you know, on their deathbed. And they had these people get in their each other's personal space. So the person with the deadly disease was like, and you know, like right up against one of these prisoners, and they're supposed to like breathe out, and then the prisoner's supposed to inhale. So they're essentially, you know, you know, almost kissing. And then they're supposed to stay in that for several minutes and have an intimate, you know, conversation really close together. And what happened was not one single person got sick.
Really?
From doing that.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's great.
Not one.
Not one.
And, you know, they repeated it several different ways, including even injecting the secretions from the sick people into the healthy people, and they still, no one got sick. Now, you know, we do exchange information with each other. That's through a variety of mechanisms.
Is that the exosome idea?
It could be exosomes. It hasn't really been scientifically shown. I mean, we know that they're in our secretions, but we don't have any evidence that they get into someone else and have a purpose. But we certainly breathe in microorganisms all the time from the surrounding environment, including from other people that we have close contact with. And, you know, those provide information about the environment to us. They communicate with our microbial cells in our body and even with our human cells, if you really can differentiate these things. You know, we have mitochondria in our cells, and it's commonly acknowledged in the mainstream scientific community that mitochondria once were independent bacteria that invaded, you know, our mammal human cells, and then were so beneficial they stayed around.
Really?
And in fact, we really, both of our metabolisms, right? We have two different ways that we metabolize fuel or glucose, you know, in our physiology. One is called glycolysis, which is similar to fermentation, where we create lactic acid. And this is a old bacterial pathway, right? And it's in many microorganisms as well. And then we have the mitochondrial metabolism, which is based on using oxygen. It's called oxidative phosphorylation, and it creates a much, much more of the, you know, so-called energy units of ATP, which probably aren't really providing energy, but they are providing necessary physiology for us to use the energy, right? And when we're in a state of disease like cancer, we actually are unable to use that more advanced oxygen mitochondrial system and revert back to the old fermentation system. And this is something that gives us a really good indication, actually, about various disease states. So, you know, we have this intimate and life-sustaining relationship with all the microorganisms in our environment that we have shown many, many times that with when those systems are damaged, we cannot be in good health, and in fact can even perish when we're not nurturing our microbes.
And Bear, we have all kinds of evidence. I mean, we just know that we are communicating with all life all the time, spiritually, right? Mentally. We're all just experiment, and we're all just exchanging information with one another, aren't we? I mean, you could just think about calling your mom, and you know, 2 minutes later she calls you. Now, come on, we know we are
exactly.
I mean, we know we are. You know, come on, the jig is up on that one, right?
You know, Rupert yeah. Sheldrake yeah. has some really interesting sure. experiments on that.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think the biggest problem we have is science, as we loosely call it these days, is really convinced that physicality is the end all.
Right.
But if you look at so-called physical form, it's a product of electrical vectors we'll loosely call waveforms. Now, if you get into waveform mechanics, which we really jump into a whole bunch, you know, in my work, we actually are measuring and manipulating those waveforms and observing changes. So, you know, you asked me earlier, Patrick, about transmission of things. Well,
right.
I believe there is a transmission, but it's on the waveform level. For instance, women these days are getting symptoms from, you know, non-vaccinated women, right. symptoms from vaccinated women. That's been, you know, pretty much out there these days. And, you know, what's really happening, it's not just pheromones, molecules floating through the air. It's actually the transmission of informational fields by way of waveforms. It's the way the physical universe is created and perpetuates itself.
Right. So this would be other than physical waveforms, astral, causal, mental, spiritual, whatever. Who knows? Well, that's above our pay grade at this moment, right?
Well, not really, no. not really. There are groups of people that I'm involved with, and some of these studies are now being introduced into graduate level studies for engineers at different universities in the world. So this is not woo-woo.
It's real.
You know, again, we are kept in the superstition of materialism, as Deepak Chopra used to say. And, you know, I strongly believe this because, again, I am involved experiments, for instance, with live cell microscopy. We can have somebody, and we've done this many times, on the, you know, on a treatment table. We can have a microscope with their blood up on the monitor, and then we can do things to that body and then watch the blood that's already been, you know, taken from their body go through changes. So we know there's a communication system there.
Yeah.
That's just the way things work. And then when you apply those principles clinically, you see changes happen, and very predictably, actually.
Yes. I've seen in my meditations and spiritual work, gentlemen, that since it's only now, and it's just one hologram, and every thought or image or feeling that I accept to be real, if I accept it as from a spiritual perspective, oh yeah, that's real. It's in my body at that moment. Just like you would see that in the blood, I would conjecture. And when you don't believe it's there,
you do.
And then it's not there. That's what my experience is, and that's kind of trippy. As a psychiatrist, Doc, you got to love that, right? If that's true, and I believe it is. Well, I mean, I've seen it.
Well, you know, this is a really fascinating field, and this is where we really need to explore and do more research.
Right.
But you're describing what's known as the observer effect. And this was, you know, discovered from a famous quantum physics experiment called the double slit experiment, where basically you had, you know, an electron beam that was shot through two slits. And then there was a photographic plate where it could be observed a certain pattern that that displayed. And there are like two patterns that the electron displays, a wave pattern and a particle pattern, right? And this is the, you know, so-called particle wave duality theory of quantum physics. But what happened is that when there's no one looking at this experiment and they analyze the photographic plate, they find that it exhibits characteristics of a wave and a particle, like in a sort of primordial state, like it doesn't commit to one or the other.
Right.
But as soon as a person observes the experiment,
yeah,
okay, that electron then commits to one path or another. And this can be repeated many, many times, but the observer doesn't exert any physical influence over the experiment.
It's just,
okay, they're just present observing. And this is really the scientific, or one scientific proof that there is a non-material force influencing the physical world, right? And you could talk about what that force is, and many people might have a different conceptualization of it, but you can't really deny the presence. And when, you know, medicine and physiology, they acknowledge the electromagnetic properties of the body in very, very limited concrete ways. Like they could do an EKG, for example, right? Which looks at the electric fields of the heart. And they can do the same thing with the brain and the muscles, right? EEGs and EMGs. But they just stop there and don't explore the how the electrical and magnetic systems of the body actually are involved in how the body works. And, you know, we know from simple like radios, right, that we have a wave in the air, in the informational space, really in the ether, and then we have a receiver, right, which is a physical thing that this waveform comes in, and the physical receiver takes the information from that waveform and turns it into sound. And then we hear music on the radio. Now, our bodies have the same exact mechanism. And in fact, probably the chromosomes are the antenna that receives the information from the field. Yeah. And we also radiate our own informational field. And this has been mapped out. And this is what we're actually detecting in those electric studies like the EKG that I described. But we've never looked at how do our fields interact with other people?
Right.
Can we exchange information directly? And I believe this is likely possible, and it's probably the mechanism why women synchronize their menstrual cycles and many other phenomenon. But this is really, really important because this could be the link with the non-material creative force.
Yes.
That it's real. That's where the information comes from in the first place. Like, think about the complexity of our bodies. Like, how many individual chemical reactions are occurring in our bodies at any given point in time? Like, we have 10 trillion cells. There could be 1,000 or 10,000 chemical processes going on in each of those 10 trillion cells at every moment in time. There's no way all of that activity could be coordinated to produce such magical and wonderful expression that we and all other creatures exhibit, all other living creatures, right? Without some source of all the information to conduct that, no way could it be contained in our brains alone.
That would be soul. We can call it soul or divine spirit or, I don't know, chi, whatever, right? It's all the same thing, God. And that's, you know, that's what we're made of though, gentlemen, right? That's, I believe, that's our essence. That's who we are. And that's why I think I've seen people over the years that when they just give it up and give it to God, and they just, when they have some kind of disease, that their body will figure it out oftentimes. Right, Barry? You've seen that. Doc, right? You've seen it.
Yeah. And, you know, in the field of such as waveform mechanics and biogeometry, we clearly recognize and differentiate between different electronic levels. And those electronic levels cannot be discerned with crude instruments that use the bottom rung of electricity, such as EKGs and that sort of thing. So it automatically dampens those other things. You know, we use instruments in my field, like this is called a dual impedance antenna. And, you know, what you were just talking about as far as DNA being an antenna, well, you have, just like this instrument, you have two rungs. And then just like a radio, you know, if you want to change the station, you move the dial and then the cursor moves, you know, on, up and down that antenna, and you're able to pick up a different bandwidth, you know, and perceive a different level of perception. And so what they're really doing, I'm convinced, with these inoculations is changing our DNA so that they cannot ping on those larger bandwidths, and literally dumbing us down to animal instinctual level and blocking those higher impulses. And what we're trying to do with medicine constantly, even in naturopathy, is just look on the ground and try to change things on the ground that are actually the product of those higher electronic levels. And meanwhile, in these other fields I'm alluding to, we're actually not just testing and measuring those higher electronic levels with different types of instrumentation, but creating changes there, and then creating at the same time coherence that then will go from top down, down to the ground, and create changes where we think of as physicality. Because these electronic levels that are actually the product of our thoughts, and given the velocity to outpicture to our senses, you know, with our emotions and other factors, what you're doing is taking informational fields that begin with those finer electrical impulses produced by our thoughts. It goes through predictably the five electrical, you know, levels of reality, and each layer kind of condenses in and compacts those informational fields to a coarsest level that we experience here on the ground that we pick up with our five physical senses. Now, civilizations and past sciences that have been suppressed knew this forever, and what we're doing is resurrecting a lot of this understanding, but then improving upon it with contemporary, you know, think of as technologies and things, and actually improving upon it. So it's not that this is some far out idea. It's as old as the hills. And the proof of the pudding is that a lot of us are actually doing it.
Doing it. And you know, what's fun to me to look at when I do it in my spiritual work, where I can view things from a spiritual level, soul level, you know, this from the viewer, Andrew, is that it's almost like, I wish I could explain, it's almost like it's just one big blob together. One holographic entity. There's no separation. You know, there's just no separation between anything, between, you know, like Patrick and maybe a pain in my stomach. You think, oh, the pain's down there, but I am the pain. You know what I'm saying? I am the pain. You know, that's where the pain is. That's me, you know? And like Lanka said, I loved it the other, about a month ago, he said something like, well, it's all God, and, why would God break itself off, a piece of itself, and create some kind of virus that's going to attack? I mean, it just, it's not even logical, right? I mean, the whole thing, if there's no separation, separation is one of the big falsities, I believe, gentlemen, that we're separate from anything. God, birds, you and me.
Yeah, there's only consciousness, and then when consciousness is put into motion through electricity, that creates a polarization, and then out of the one comes many.
Out of the one comes
but
many.
But it's really not many, it's only the appearance of many by the creation of motion through those electrical vectors.
And that would give credence to the idea, I think it was a biblical thing, I don't know, resist not evil, that when we, something comes at us that we don't like, right, and we resist it, it just gets stronger, because you know, we've created the idea that it's separate from us and that we have to fight it off, a virus, the government, whatever. But if we know that it can't hurt us and we don't resist it, where does it go? It doesn't exist.
Things can only...
I mean, you know, it can't hurt us. It can't hurt us, right? It just can't hurt us.
Right.
Well, you know, Patrick, if everyone just ignored the, you know, government mandates and went about their business, of course, they would just disappear.
It'd be all right. They'd the be same gone, thing. Right? Yeah. Be, same thing. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I guess as a psychiatrist, Dr. Kaufman, this is very interesting because I guess 30 or 40 years ago, you guys were saying, you know, it's all in your head. And you know what? You got laughed at, but it was in a sense, right? It was.
Yeah, well, you know, this is like really the problem because you have, once again, there's a polarization in medicine, right? You have all of the regular doctors are separate really from psychiatrists. Psychiatrists, you know, the only ones that don't wear a white coat and don't carry a stethoscope. And, you know, so all the doctors basically, you know, they say, well, disease is physical, right? Because they're all materialist.
Right.
And then they're like, you know, oh, those psychiatrists, like when we have someone who's a pain in the ass to deal with, that's when we call the psychiatrist. Or when they use the S word, suicide, right? Then up, call the psychiatrist, right? Because we can handle the liability. But we're not taken seriously because, you know, they're like, oh God, they just give those medicines and like subdue people. And, you know, they're not really scientific. And, you know, we really in psychiatry have almost no understanding. But what we have observed, although most people maybe not acknowledge it in the field, is that people can get sick from purely psychological reasons, physically sick.
Sure.
And people can be psychologically ill from purely physical reasons. And mostly it's actually an interaction between
as above,
the physical
so below
and
as below,
and
so
the
above.
Psychospiritual.
Right. Goes back and forth.
Yeah, that's certainly a way of looking at it.
Mm.
And, you know, and that you can't really help any individual unless you look at the totality of the situation, including the psycho-spiritual aspects and the physical aspects. And that is really what's largely missing, which is, you know, why I left allopathic medicine.
Sure. We're talking with Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Bear Paul Londo. It is we're live here, July 21. I'm not going to do any commercials today because I'm having too much fun. I don't care. Okay, so so Bear, you're a herbalist and you do all this stuff. What I'm really curious about, if we take the idea that everything is a spiritual, mental, emotional thing, you know, it's all one big blob of God. So even if we do the best herbs ever for this or that or kidney, would you say that we're going to really have to deal with the spiritual thing to really heal, have the body heal? That the herbs are not going to do it unless we let go of whatever trauma or engram or whatever that is. What do you think about that?
I'd strongly agree with that. And I'd base it on a lot of clinical experience where people would come in with these serious illnesses, you know, a diagnosis, and they lead perfect lives. They eat only pure food. They're actually, you know, very rigid about it, you know, even. And then they say, possibly get sick. I'm good. I do all the right things. And then meanwhile, you see somebody else who's smoking a pack a day, downing a sixer every night, and they're fine and they don't get sick. So,
right.
You know, really our attitude, you know, our emotions and thought patterns have everything to do with, you know, what happens on the cellular level. Now, if you couple a growing awareness, you know, a person who's developing their consciousness to understand more the depth of, you know, who they are in the first place and why they're here and how this whole simulation works, then, you know, those people tend to just gravitate towards more pure foodstuffs, cleaner lifestyles, in the, you know, just the simple things, and don't tend to pollute themselves as much. So what you're doing then, and you might even, you know, notice that when you take herb, it has a certain effect and it feels good and you really get the hang of it that way. But what you're doing then is, you know, not leading with a physical substance, which brings you back into the box of superstition, thinking that something on the ground is going to fix anything in the first place, because now you might as well just be doing allopathic medicine.
Wow.
Now, at least it doesn't have as many toxic consequences, maybe, you know, as some of the pharmaceuticals and things, but you're still placing you know, you're empowering something outside of yourself. Sir. And I believe we're here to realize that we're the source of everything in the first place.
That's probably what we signed up for this lifetime, gentlemen. Probably, right? I think that's what this COVID thing is about. I really do. I think it's just God's way of saying, okay, kids, wake up, smell the coffee here. Something's not right, you know, and it's my theory.
Patrick, you know, each health problem that people have could be also looked upon as kind of like a test or a classroom experience because, you know, I agree with Bear. It takes this kind of totality of approach. And, you know, I do want to add, though, that herbs are also imbued with these spiritual and divine origins, right? And so that is part of the reason why they can be helpful. But it's really the journey that the person is willing to embark upon that is going to produce the healing.
Yeah.
Because if they're going to be honest, if they're going to put in the effort, they're going to discover the, you know, those toxic thought patterns or toxic relationships or the unresolved childhood trauma or, you know, whatever it is, that's that part of the equation. They're going to maybe even understand that, you know, their relationship with consciousness is corrupted and in conflict. And if they have the wherewithal to be open to these ideas and be willing to put, you know, the effort to delineating a path for their own individual learning and healing and to actually take the necessary action to carry that out, it's all of this together, right? And this is why the allopathic model is such a failure, because it relies on someone else to do the work.
Yeah.
Right? You go to them, they do all the work, they give you the pill, and that pill fixes everything. right? So they say.
Yeah.
But, you know, how could it, you know, I saw so many times, right, people have trouble in their job, trouble in their marriage, and then we're told to give them a pill. Now, how does a pill make your job better? How does a pill make your spouse nicer? Right? It's not possible, but yet people walk away thinking that it will solve the problem.
Yes.
And because it's hard work to say, you know, go to your wife or husband and say, hey, our relationship is broken. Can we fix it?
Yes, sir.
You know, that's not easy. Then sometimes it can't be fixed.
And as a psychiatrist, I'm sure you've known, you probably went through it at the early, I don't know, you can tell me, but if somebody has a belief that is impeding on their health and their spirituality, some strong belief about whatever, my wife or whatever, the government, and if you give them a pill so they feel better, and as many psychiatrists do, God love them, man, I mean, that's a recipe. There's no way that can help them. So they get whacked, you know, with Oxycontin or something, you know. It's just dangerous, isn't it? Just dangerous.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
That's why you got out of the business, right?
Yeah, and, you know, and for the last 3 years I was in the business, I was just basically taking teenage kids off medicines.
Oh, yeah. Like Miss Kelly.
Try, you know, try and undo the damage and try to actually talk to them.
Yeah. What a concept. On the herbal thing, too, I think it's interesting to kind of think about the idea that if we do things, whether it be sweating, exercise, meditation, herbs, vitamins, whatever, and we kind of feel better physically, that can help us to do the spiritual work, right? Because we feel better. We feel better. And we just have more juice and more mojo and say, well, maybe I'll try that.
Yeah. What I observed in clinic was that, you know, when I administered an herb, a homeopathic, or even applied a physical modality such as meridian therapy or osteopathy, you know, or any other kinds of technologies, it was always done first with testing that would allow me to understand what that modality would do on a level of resonance to create further balance in that particular body. Now, you could take a individual that would come in, they're scared to death, they just got the diagnosis, and they don't want to hear any of the things that we're discussing. So working on that level, we would create that balance, create fundamental changes at the core of their being, and then a few months down the road, they'd fit right in with this conversation, They're talking about maybe changing their relationship, their job, moving somewhere else on the planet, and they're different human beings. So, you know, I don't want to give the impression that I don't think anything, you know, physical, as far as physical medicine, isn't any good. I think it's how about it. Pharmaceuticals override natural processes. Now, if you're looking at herbs and things relative to chemical constituents only, you have the tendency to fall in the same boat. But if you're working on resonance and understanding how to achieve that with these things and finding that compatibility, now you're not just going to be making physical changes through that medium, but you're making physical changes by creating, again, coherence on those higher levels that will then settle down and make physical changes on the ground. But for different reasons that allopathy or even a lot of herbalists really appreciate. Yeah. And every, Andrew is completely correct when he says, you know, they have a lot of these natural patterns in them. Well, we can study herbs and homeopathy and things and identify, you know, very precise resonant fields. And so what you're doing there is applying a medium that can deliver waveforms in a certain concentration to achieve a balance. Hmm.
This is a great email from Emily. She is in San Francisco, the Golden Gate. So what happens a couple times a year when I get the flu? Did I create the flu, or ask your guests, do we catch a flu virus? That's a great question. That's great. People catch the flu all the time, right? Catch a cold? Gentlemen, each of you do it.
Well, I don't know. You know, you'd have to go around wearing a baseball glove, I think, to properly catch it. But no, this is just a perception. What happens is that every year when it gets colder and the humidity drops, we see more death. In fact, if you look at people, you know, just the overall death curves, you'll see that the majority of the deaths occur during those cold, dry winter months. And that's when colds and flu also occur. And so what I think happens is that these environmental changes provide a signal to our body to undergo normal processes. And, you know, death is a normal process, mm-hmm. right? It is certain for all of us. And, you know, now we don't have any of the high quality scientific research looking at alternative mechanisms of the flu, because all we have is this flawed and fraudulent virus related science where, you know, the influenza virus also has never been shown to exist. So what I think is going on is that essentially this is your air filter change, because, you know, your breathing apparatus is working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 and a quarter days a year without stop. And, you know, we've all changed the air filter in our heating systems or in the cabin filter in our vehicle. And when you pull that out, right, it looks pretty disgusting. Well, as you can imagine, those things are not running around the clock. So what's the inside of our nose and throat and lungs must look like after a full year, right? If we're not actively cleaning it out all the time, mm-hmm. We need a big clean out. And that's pretty much what a cold and flu is. And the more toxic crap that we've accumulated in that time, you know, based on our lifestyle, including those psycho-spiritual aspects, then we're going to be more or less ill, you know, when we have that expression of the detoxification. And if we're at the stage of our life that our body is basically on its way out, then that could be the event that puts us, you know, to the next realm. But it's quite, you know, straightforward and simple. And, you know, all those secretions, that's the old filter material being washed away.
So essentially a detox, cold and flu detox. So, but better than that would be the root then of all disease, right? It gets built up and then you get a pain or you, whatever, and you go to the doctor and he says, well, you have cancer or whatever. That's the same thing that's happening. The body's trying to heal, but we don't have the information globally to understand what's going on.
Yeah, nature only self-corrects and self-maintains. You know, I live on a farm and I observe every winter they're composting outside. You know, all the abundance of the spring and summer needs to be returned to the soil so that we can have a new, you know, prolific growing season. And we are not separate from nature. So our bodies follow those same cycles. When we go into those colder months, you know, there's reasons, you know, why trees lose their leaves. It's an interaction between the atmosphere and higher nitrogen levels. It thickens the sap, and then that changes the dynamics of, you know, fluids entering the leaves, so they drop and die. So our body, you know, follows all those same mechanisms at the same exact time. And when I look under a microscope, I'll notice during those times, and people with those kinds of symptoms, they have an abundance of certain microorganisms that have developed into certain developmental cycles, that, you know, where those microorganisms may be in a fungal or a bacterial phase, will start secreting enzymes and do all sorts of things that digest old dead material or diseased, you know, tissues in the body to get rid of it. The only problem with that is it brings symptoms, because then your body needs to expel those things. You know, your mucous membranes will swell up in an effort to, you know, clean house and wash out the nasal sinuses in your upper respiratory system. You might be upchucking or going at both ends. It's a very natural mechanism. Now, those of us that get the clue that, hey, maybe we can do our own gradual composting year round, day in, day out, then, you know, when it comes to those times of the year when we used to get that seasonal cold or flu, we don't do that anymore. And so it's very, you know, this stuff isn't rocket science. Again, it goes back to the original empirical method. The true scientists, it just simply observed and mimicked nature.
Yeah, but it's completely opposite, of course, 180 degrees from everything that's going on in allopathy all over the world, and has been for, what, 100 years or, I don't know, long time.
Since, well, you Patrick, you can't make much money from letting nature take its course, can you?
Not a lot of money in there. This is a great question. So this is from George. So what about chemtrails? If they're spraying aluminum in chemtrails, can we breathe them in and get poisoned and share those? I don't know much about chemtrails except what I've read over the years. I don't even know if they exist. I don't know if it's all tinfoil hat stuff myself.
I think it's been pretty well characterized by several government whistleblowers who have directly observed the program and provided, you know, video footage of the containers of chemicals and the sprays. And you can certainly observe these patterns in the sky. But, you know, and of course we can breathe in aluminum, just like we eat aluminum when we use aluminum foil to store or cook with our food, or use aluminum cookware. But I don't think that we're going to get huge amounts of aluminum toxicity from chemtrails because of the same factors I mentioned before, the massive degree of dilution that occurs in the atmosphere. And then also our lungs, just like our gut, are very good at keeping those things out of the body. So only a very, very tiny amount, if we breathe it in or if we swallow it, less than 1% of that aluminum actually gets past those barriers and enters our internal body.
That's what our lungs
really
do.
Cause damage.
That's what our lungs do for a living, Doc. Wow.
Yes, exactly. But when there's aluminum added to vaccines as an adjuvant, and it's in every vaccine pretty much, except for these genetic vaccines because they're not vaccines, that aluminum is much, much more dangerous because 100% of it gets internally inside of our body. There's no physical barrier because that barrier is penetrated by the needle. So, you know, in my opinion, the aluminum causing disease, which I believe it's responsible for a lot of illness, especially neurologic illness, it really, the source of it is from vaccines and not from air pollution or from food.
Is it an interesting, or is it a reasonable conjecture to say, gentlemen, that no matter what we put into our body, I don't know, no matter what, if that's a good term, that the body's going to figure out a way to get rid of it, pretty much?
I believe that's absolutely true. And I agree with everything Andrew is saying. I always default back to clinical experience and just observation. So, you know, I was in practice for over 40 years. So if I look at the incidence of certain neurological degenerative disorders early on in my career, they're very rare. And now all of those things became epidemic over the years. Again, I can't prove how that's happening, but when we do methods that help the body purge or chelate those substances out of the body, we notice that the nervous system does regenerate itself when we combine it with other therapies. So I think there's really something to the fact that we're getting a source of poison in some way. And of course, these substances, as Andrew says, they're in medicines, they're food, in cosmetics, they're everywhere. And there are a few people on the planet that are taking measurements every day, atmospheric water, and you name it, in the soil, and they are finding an abundance of these substances. And so how much of that actually gets into our body? I know for a fact that on the farm here, and over the years, because I've done this for a long time, you notice that plant life is reacting to these things too. But I always go back to the fact that the body is absolutely miraculous in its ability to purge anything and correct itself and even adapt in ways that makes it impervious to the stuff in the first place. So we have everything within inside of ourselves, to fix things, but the one impediment to allowing our biology just to do what it's designed to do is when we go into an emotional state such as fear, which lowers the systemic resonance and then doesn't allow those mechanisms to work in the first place.
So do you think then just being in fear of anything, just holding on to that fear in our consciousness, and it goes subconsciously, so we don't, right? Then that could lower our ability to be good with a lot of things on planet Earth, right? Just a lot of different things, couldn't it? And just the resonance of our body is such. In my opinion, I think that would also work with the 5G and all that stuff. If we were in fear of it, It's got to be much more powerful against us, and I, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, fear. Fear is a state that is really, I think, in nature should be a temporary, and that it provides us motivation to act quickly in a situation of real danger. But when we are manipulated into chronic fear states, it really has so many detrimental effects. And one thing I want to bring up, being from the psychological field, has to do with behavioral conditioning. That it's, well known in the research, and behavioral conditioning is like, stimulus, response, reward, kind of thing, like Pavlov's dog, training people or animals to do things, that people are much, much more easily conditioned behaviorally when in a fear state. And we saw this come about with the mask issue, right? We went from people never wearing masks except for, surgeons, to now suddenly like everyone is wearing a mask. And that's because there was this conditioning program, right, that you're a good person if you wear a mask, you're protecting your community, right? And they even had the punishment access, side of things, right, that if you don't wear it, you're killing grandma. And we know from leaked documents that the government's actually hired psychologists to come up with these strategies to be the most effective and to generate the most fear, like this happened in the UK for certain, because there's a whistleblower who wrote a book about it. So, this is instrumental in the manipulation, is to generate the fear. And of course, it also results in illness, and not just, the kind of illnesses like that would just be worse in general, right? Like someone with heart disease or diabetes, that it might get worse if they're in fear, but also things like suicide, like drug addiction and overdoses. Those things are compounded by fear also.
Yeah.
Right. And we saw substantial increases in those unfortunate outcomes. So this is a, calculated and systematic program to use fear to, manipulate in all of these ways that are harmful for us.
And we have no idea, no way of knowing of how many people, millions maybe, checked into the hospital the last 18 months because they were feeling badly. And they could have brought this all on, not a lot of them, just by fearing some virus or not being happy with being closed up or not being happy with not being able to hug people or wear a mask, right? It could have brought on a lot of different symptoms. So they went to the doctor or they went to the hospital and said, I've got COVID.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly could have. I didn't get it.
Go ahead, Bear.
Go ahead, Bear. Andrew.
Well, I was just going to comment.
Sorry, that's my voice lag on my satellite. You go. I'll be quiet.
Well, just quickly, I wanted to say they weren't going to the hospitals, Patrick, because we've seen footage from all over the world that hospitals have been empty, right? But yeah, if they got sick, they believed themselves to have COVID, right, because of this fear. So that is major.
But also, Bear, go ahead and address that, and I have another question for you, Bear. Go ahead.
I was going to simply say that, a chronic state of anxiety also for long-term consequences, because our neurology goes through morphological changes to accommodate the chemical reactions that are produced by those anxiety states. So now, our nerves are like on a train track, right, and we just keep ourselves in that constant state.
Yeah.
So it really takes some effort, and a lot of inner work, and really understanding the truth of things to literally change our neurology back to a normal state so that we aren't seeing all the symptoms that then can be attributed to a disease.
Yeah, and I think it can be argued that just this constant state of even a little bit of tension, say being 1 or 2 on a 10, as most of us walk around and we're working on not doing it on planet Earth, can have all kinds of challenges with our health, right? I mean, just this idea that something could jump out of the bushes and get us. I don't care whether it be a virus or a snake or, an elephant, I don't know, a tiger or, an IRS guy, tension, right? Tension, tension. Wow. Bear, Paul Londo are with us, and also Andrew Kaufman. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. This is great fun. This is from Dan in Cleveland. How do we explain the fact that no one seems to be getting chickenpox or mumps anymore, diagnosed as other diseases? Do you understand? How do we explain the fact that no one seems to be getting chickenpox or mumps anymore? Well, kids get chickenpox and mumps, don't they? I don't understand the question.
Yeah, sure they do.
I don't.
Go ahead, Andrew.
No, you, Bear, please.
Well, I was just going to say, a lot of the so-called diseases that were eradicated by vaccines, if you, really research historically the truth of that, like, say, take polio, by the time they came out with the polio vaccine, the polio was already on the wane. It was, it's not a problem anymore. And then, of course, if you really look a little closer, you find that the vaccinated population started developing other neurological problems that we, term meningitis and that sort of thing. So a lot of the diseases that were so-called eradicated by vaccines really weren't. They were brought about by changes in hygiene and lifestyle and just basic improvements, that help people live healthier lives. It's hard to address some of these things too, because we really have to go in deeper into the connection between the psyche and how the psyche triggers reactions in the brain that then create biological responses in corresponding tissues. And that has been proven out very definitively through things like New German Medicine, where Dr. Hammer, did thousands of CAT scans and identified the, with lesions on the brain and associated them with different psychological insults that then would trigger precise parts of the body that would biologically express the burden on the psyche. So there's just so much that we don't pay attention to or don't even acknowledge that would explain all of these things. And when you get into, like chicken pox, measles, those always have a component that can be explained very very handily with New German Medicine, and it doesn't have anything to do with a virus.
So they could be detox or a rite of passage for the kids to kind of let go after hanging out in the uterus for 9 months and whatever else they've been doing.
Yeah, and some of these things actually impart informational fields that are very healthy in the long term of our life cycle. And so when that's impeded with pharmaceuticals, it can actually make us less healthy, not just because of the toxicity, because it impedes these natural processes that are, you know, giving us the information that we need to properly go through different developmental stages.
So when people go to measles parties and because mom wants, okay, go ahead and get them, go ahead and drink a cup out of, you know, go to your measles or mumps party, it doesn't necessarily mean they're exchanging something physically. They could be exchanging information on all these different levels we've been talking about, the cool stuff, right? Spiritual and wavelengths and all of that. And that's why, and that comes up a lot with the whole show me the virus germ theory fraudulent idea that often I hear, well, wait a minute, no. I mean, my whole family got COVID and my whole family got the flu at the same time. What do you say to those folks, Dr. Kaufman, when you hear that? And I'm sure you've heard it, right? No, we all got the flu.